Well, this week the Royal Institution in Adelaide opens with great fanfare, and we'll take you on a tour on Catalyst this coming Thursday. That's ABC Television, 8 o'clock, ABC One. But already up and running, just, is the Darwin Centre Part 2 at the Natural History Museum in London. Before we take a look around, here's David Attenborough at the opening ceremony.
Your Royal Highness, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I am quite sure that I am not the only one who came here as a little boy or a little girl, 6, 7, 8 years old, and had our minds blown by the extraordinary things we saw. That sense of wonder is indeed one of the most important things that this museum can do, particularly since we are increasingly cut off from the natural world. It's a paradox, isn't it, that we, as mankind, know more about the natural world than we have ever done in history, and yet at this particular moment, over 50% of the human race is urbanized to some degree. That sense of wonder has stayed with me, as I'm sure it has stayed with you, throughout our lives. But soon after that, one became aware that this institution is even more than an instrument for instilling wonder in the young. It is a crucial research centre for the science of geology, paleontology, mineralogy, entomology, marine biology. And never in the history of mankind has it been more important that we should understand what those sciences have to tell us. For there is no question, beyond any doubt whatsoever, that the human race now has the future of this planet in its hands. If it is to handle that sensibly, properly, responsibly, if we are to ensure the prosperity of the human race in coming generations, we have to understand the natural world. We have to realize that we are dependent upon the natural world. And the realization of the sort of information that we are dependent upon is what this extraordinary, wonderful, amazing extension of the Natural History Museum will give us. It's our luck that the royal family has taken a personal and powerful interest in natural history and all that it involves. Something that was started by the Duke of Edinburgh, that passed on to the Prince of Wales. And now one hopes that torch is being passed on to the next generation. It's my great privilege and honour to introduce Prince William of Wales to address us.
I assure you, Sir David, that torch has been firmly given over and will be something that will be looked upon with great interest into the future. Before I start, I'd just like to say I do hope all of you had a chance to go and have a look around the museum. It is fantastic. Just to warn you, though, that there is a tarantula on the loose somewhere in the cocoon. It was given to me and I seem to have lost it. If you see it, she goes by the name of Sarah. So if you could usher her towards someone who looks equally as petrified as I was, that would be most grateful. I remember coming here first as a child with my mother. Millions of others will have shared with me and Sir David that sense of awe and wonder and just a shiver of something more as you step off the street to stare into the beady eye of the blue whale or the terrifying eye socket of a T-Rex. A moment never to be forgotten, especially when everything is a lot bigger than you. That whole experience sparked in me a love of the natural world, which has stayed with me and still grows within me. How it works, how the natural balance depends on us, how we depend on it. Encouraged by my father, this boyhood fascination has developed into an interest in how we, as members of the human race, meet the challenges now facing us and our planet. So this place is fun, perhaps the most fun you can have in London as a child. But it is something so much more than that. As the superb new facilities of the Darwin Centre show, the Natural History Museum and the dedicated people who work here are at the very forefront of research. seeking out through study of the natural world the answers to these great questions of our age. It is therefore such a privilege for me to be asked here today to open the Darwin Centre. The Natural History Museum is one of our great institutions. Its collections and what it achieves in the areas of research and education make it, quite simply, the envy of the world. This magnificent new wing will further enhance the museum's peerless reputation. It gives me great pleasure in declaring the second phase of the Darwin Centre open.
This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm at the Natural History Museum in South Kensington in London, where I was many years ago when the first part of the Darwin Centre was opened, and now we've got the second part, the cocoon, and all sorts of lovely, amazing things. Here is the director, Michael Dixon. What are we in for?
Well, the Darwin Centre completes our new life science complex. So phases one and two, now complete over 10 years, cost the museum about £110 million, so an enormous investment. Phase two takes the concept a little further. There are three principal objectives. First of all, to provide new state-of-the-art collection storage. In the case of this, the second phase for our dry collections. Second major objective is to provide state-of-the-art research labs for our scientists. Clearly, if we have scientists doing competitive work on a global basis, then they need competitive facilities in which to do that. And third, last but not least, it's very important to the museum as a publicly funded body to demonstrate the public value of the science that we do. And the best way we feel of doing that is to bring the public much closer to our collections and to our science, to see why we have the collections, the extent of them, the sort of research that's done using those collections, and how that work is relevant to people's daily lives.
Well, the first phase, you kind of pioneered showing the scientists working so that the public can go over and say, yeah, what you doing? And that interaction went quite well, didn't it?
It did, albeit on a relatively modest scale. What we wanted to do with this, the second phase, was to expand the experience to be able to show to our visitors more of the science that goes on behind the scenes without having to provide tour guides to actually physically take them behind the scenes. So this building has got very interesting vistas where the public can see our scientists can see the public, as well as traditional museum exhibitions.
Where'd you get the £120 million?
That was the cost of the two phases. This second phase has cost us just over £78 million. About 11 of that was a direct government grant. We had £20 million from the Heritage Lottery Fund, £10 million from the Wellcome Trust, and then a whole succession of smaller amounts of money. The museum itself, through its commercial activities, or the profit on those commercial activities, will have made a contribution of about £15 million to the project as well.
Before we go in, what's your own background as a biologist?
Well, I trained as a zoologist at Imperial College London. I did a doctorate at the University of York, and I'm a parasitologist. In fact, my doctorate was on the host location mechanisms used by larval trematodes. But for the next 20 years, I worked in scientific technical medical publishing, then saw the light and decided to give up corporate life, and I ran the Zoological Society of London for 4 years before I came here.
Which included the zoo, of course.
It included London Zoo, as well as Whipsnade Wild Animal Park, also a research institute.
Introduce me to your colleague over there.
I have with me Paul Bowers, who is project director for the public programmes in Darwin Centre Phase 2.
Paul, how do you control the public in a vast building like this, where they're wandering in and out of precious areas?
Well, what we've made sure in the building from the very beginning of the architectural design is that we can meet all of these fundamentally different objectives for the three functions of the building that Mike has described. So collections need to be dark, they need to be secure, they need to be in temperature-controlled conditions. We can't let the public wander through. So what we've done is we have created a public route around the building that kind of wraps around all of the science areas, kind of like spaghetti around a fork. That means that we can offer views into spaces like the Sloan Herbarium, which has some of our oldest botanical specimens, our laboratory spaces where we do molecular research into diseases such as malaria, and in some of our specimen preparation and storage areas. So the public can go round in such a way that they are able to view the scientists and interact with the scientists, but not physically overlap with any of those areas of work.
And it's pretty damn big, isn't it? 8 stories high. Huge.
It's huge. Well, there's a lot to fit in it. We've got 20 million specimens in the building, all housed within this gigantic cocoon. We then have about 200 scientists within Darwin Centre, and then we're obviously expecting a great response from our visitors, including schools and formal learning as well.
Take me around.
Well, we have two main areas of the building. The cocoon journey is where people go round the spaghetti around the fork and have all of these views. Then downstairs in the Attenborough studio, we have a 64-seater space where we'll be running daily shows where you can actually meet one of our scientists every day. We also have got state-of-the-art technology there for showing natural history films and special events for families. We include shows with live animals, for example. That's a daily changing programme where we can get visitors in to actually meet our scientists in the real flesh.
Can we go and have a look?
We certainly can.
Right, here we are in one of the rather elegant main entrances. Way up in the sky, I can see down South Kensington out the window, and this bloody great big round thing, what's that?
That is the cocoon. It's 28 metres high, it's 65 metres long, and it's made of polished Venetian plaster. That is the storehouse. That's where all the precious things are stored in their ideal, perfect conditions. And then the space we're in now is the public space that is starting to wrap around all of those collection spaces. So the key for the building really is all the way around this cocoon, there are these light, airy spaces where the public and scientists could come and do their actual work.
It's very pleasant here. It is wonderfully light and spacious. And in front of me, the big glass case with moths, plants, all sorts of things. What is this?
This is the first thing that visitors come to when they begin the cocoon journey. What we're trying to do here is just show visitors at the very beginning the kind of things that we have here, and they can start to interrogate them. Here's a good example as well. There is a lot of interactivity through Darwin Centre, and we're also using barcode swipes that enable you to, on your personal card, collect all sorts of different bits of content, images, video links and so on, and access those later on from home. And most importantly then on our website, some of the scientists whose workspaces you'll be seeing through the tour, you're able then to see their blogs and so on our website. So it's all part of making that our science as accessible as we possibly can, giving people many, many ways to get
their
involved.
Their blogs, they've got nowhere to hide, have they?
They don't hide at all, but they don't want to hide. Our scientists are tremendously passionate people. They love sharing the work they do. They love talking to the public. So for them to be able to take blogs, be able to come and talk to the visitors in the Attenborough studio, all of that is it's kind of meat and drink for them.
And Mike, what's the touchscreen you're playing with there? You had lovely poppies everywhere before.
Yes, the touchscreens here in the introductory lobby introduce people to how these screens actually work. And in this particular one, this is telling us what our collection items can actually tell us scientists and the general public. So this is an example using British poppies.
What is this?
It says, what is this? You touch it, it brings up some text, a dried plant from the botany collection, the common poppy. If we wait for a minute, it will bring up a picture of the herbarium sheet, and it will successively tell you more and more information about that particular species.
Wonderfully elegant images. They're really pretty as well, aren't they? They're not just scientifically sound, they're works of art.
They are. We believe that the image quality is very important, and as you can see, they're very engaging. Finally, the Nature Plus here, there's a little symbol, Nature Plus. If we press that, you can see it brings up a Nature Plus screen. I can now choose what I want to store and swipe my card, close it down, take my card home, and I can interrogate our website with a special number and relive the experience.
Now, we're very privileged. There's only a couple of us standing here. What if there are 4 million thrusting and pushing and leaning on the glass? And How's that going to work?
Well, we're standing on the seventh floor. Access to this floor is via lifts. We can control the rate of public access to this space by the speed of the lifts. So we intend to have a regular throughput of people arriving by lift, and as one lot leaves, the next lot arrive.
Crowd control, I love it. Okay, Paul, where do we go next?
Well, now we're going to go across this beautiful glass bridge where to the left you can see the cocoon, to the right you can see the back of the old Waterhouse building. So you've got the 19th century museum right next to the 21st century Darwin Centre. And as we walk down the corridor, we'll turn in and we're going to go inside the cocoon. So the first thing you can see is the great big cocoon walls here, nice and thick. These hold the building up and keep the conditions right, so it helps keep the building cool. And here we start a video presentation where we introduce our science guides, that's what we call them. Four of our curators have been filmed. They pop up on screen and in the interactives throughout the experience to help explain what the interactives are all about. You think of them like a concierge. They're here to host you through your journey.
Yes. Gosh, this place is big. And along the walls you've got images coming and going. And there are some famous people. I can see Charles Darwin himself.
The area we're standing now is in front of our historic collection store, and featured, you can see in racks behind the glass, is the famous Hans Sloane Herbarium. Hans Sloane, of course, his collections were the basis of the original British Museum, of which the Natural History Museum used to be a part. So they're, of course, an incredibly important, very historic part of our collection. But this introduces the idea of the great collectors over many, many years. So the interactives here talk about Wallace, they talk about Darwin, they talk about Banks, they talk about Sloane and many other collectors.
Mr. Wallace looked like Father Christmas, very friendly, smiling face. And of course, Charles Darwin, you know the pictures, wearing a bowler hat there. Banks, who came to Australia. Sloane, anything to do with Sloane Square?
Absolutely. You're quite right. Many areas around South Kensington, Sloane Square, Han Street, all relate back to Hans Sloane himself.
Tiny bit like my auntie with a curly wig on. Not a very happy fellow, but concentrating, I suppose. And here we're looking through to some very, very big, very modern labs.
We're at the other end of the cocoon now. We've walked down the length of the cocoon. We're looking out of a panoramic window that overlooks our molecular laboratories, one of our molecular laboratories. So we're looking at the robot that does all the processing and some of the staff who are in there doing their research. What's really important for us is to show the work that we're doing here as it is done in the flesh. Key activities that go on in here, for example, we do research into malaria. Using molecular sequencing techniques, we can understand which specific mosquito is spreading the disease in which specific area, and that helps us pick the right control method, so minimising the spread of the disease. So really important work goes on here that then has a major impact on the lives of people living in Africa.
I think there are about four mosquitoes we need to worry about in terms of the disease, and 60 different species all in all that carry various malarias for other animals.
It's of that order, yes, and the key thing for us is by using our taxonomic expertise we can understand better. It's a different way of controlling. It's complementary to all the other mechanisms that exist for controlling malaria.
Now, as you look through the window, you can see what looks like a pretty damn space-age laboratory. But Mike, many museums around the world, given the GFC, the global financial crisis, etc., and funds and all the rest of it, have kind of downsize their scientific efforts. Has that affected you at all?
To date, no. But of course, we are heavily reliant on government funding. About two-thirds of our gross income comes directly from government grant. It's very important to us that that's maintained in the future.
But the scientists are the backbone of this museum, aren't they? And you've got, what, you said a couple of hundred of them?
We have about 350 people working in our science departments. They are indeed the backbone of the organisation. All of our public displays, all of our public programmes are underpinned by the excellent science done by museum scientists. And I think that's incredibly important for the institution. I think it's very important too for public confidence.
What's this?
This interactive is fantastic. Demonstrating the mosquitoes and malaria problem that Paul referred to. This touch table, you can catch mosquitoes with pooters.
Oh yeah, fingers going on screen and killing the little buggers, and they're going zap.
They're actually being captured. They're being now put into vials.
Yes.
I'm now going to do some DNA sequencing on them.
You're kidding.
So here we go. We're now in the DNA sequencing lab. This is all happening on screen. We're preparing the DNA by crushing. We're now washing.
Half full of liquid and...
Now we're replicating the DNA using polymerase chain reaction. Heating and cooling in the PCR machine.
The PCR actually multiplies these tiny bits by zillions so that you get unlimited numbers, actually. I think Carey Mullis got the Nobel Prize for that, didn't he?
Absolutely right. And now we're running gels, so applying the electric current. And now placing an ultraviolet light. And now we're going to get the DNA sequence of the mosquito that we captured. Here we go. We captured 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 of them. And as you can see, we have actually captured 3 different species of mosquitoes. Anopheles epiroticus, Anopheles nivipes, and Anopheles cytonoides. And now we can look at control measures for each of these species, again using the touchscreens. And subsequently, we'll be able to see whether those control measures actually have the desired effect. So a nice way of showing how the basic biology leads to something very applied and gives the public an opportunity to see that link in a very tangible, real example.
Beautifully done. Onwards.
One of the things we wanted to do was to introduce a new exhibit on climate change. We wanted, because our public responds to this in a very major way, to have something new and different that reflected the pace of change of that particular debate. So here we are in front of the interactive wall. This is a wall of touchscreens about 30 metres long. Lots and lots of individual screens. It has gesture recognition technology, so as you walk up to it from a distance, it will actually change. It's currently in test mode. Members of the public can go up, touch the screens, and start to interrogate the museum's own work on climate change, as well as known work from elsewhere.
Well, the pictures are, again, glorious. They're wonderful colours, they're clear, and they're of lots of fish from, as I recognise, almost certainly some from the Barrier Reef. You've got little clownfish going through. There's certainly the odd Nemo here, going through the waving coral fronds, and you've also got big faces of large fish, some that look almost like eels, and the odd killer whale. So you're concentrating very much on the plight of the reefs around the world.
That's right. It happens to be cycling at the moment through a sequence on how fast we're losing coral reefs. So let's go and touch the screen.
News was coming out only last month on the dire situation of many of the reefs, including the GBR, the Great Barrier Reef.
Absolutely. And, of course, what's now come up is the comment that when we're losing coral reefs faster than we're losing rainforests. And here we've got the interactives now cycling into the release of chemical carbon dioxide into the air, and it will explain how that creates acid rain and how that acid rain acidifies the oceans and bleaches coral reefs.
And of course the growth of the skeletons, the structure of the corals themselves, are actually being interfered with, so the shell formation as well is being reduced.
Absolutely. So the rate of replacement of coral reefs is also much slower than it might have been historically.
Well, Michael Dixon, the director of the museum, congratulations. And I'm sure you're going to be able to handle thousands of new visitors. Is that your hope?
We certainly hope so. The museum's been on an upward trend for visits anyway. We're around 3.8 million visits a year at the moment. And we think with Darwin Centre, we're likely to achieve 4 million visits in a year for the first time.
And let me know what you think of the public's appreciation of the science. A very brave thing to do and very necessary thing to do, it seems to me. But whether it's going to work is part of this big experiment.
Well, this is a very important factor for us. We want the perception of this organisation in the public's mind to shift subtly from that wonderful Victorian building with the dinosaurs to a modern 21st century science organisation that communicates its science in extraordinary ways to the general public.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, now I've moved out into the open.
under the sky. You can probably hear the planes. And it's still very, very modern looking. And I've been joined by Johannes Vogel, which of course means bird, but you're a botanist.
I'm a botanist, yes indeed, because birds and other animals need to live off something, and plants is probably the best thing there is, including for us as humans.
And what's the big secret with plants in this wonderful new centre?
Well, life on Earth depends on plants, and they will get pride of place here. Long time coming, but ever so necessary. We have the most comprehensive collection of plants in relation to diversity as well as time and space in the world here, and that needs to be preserved for future generations of scientists and the public alike, and therefore we need a fantastic new building to be able to dispense our obligations.
And what does the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew say about that, the 250 years old? Are they slightly envious of you, or do you interact very happily?
We interact very happily with our sister institutions. They are a world-class scientific institution as we are. They cover plants and a bit of fungi. We cover life on Earth. So it's a very, very good mix and match here, being so close together and being able to work together to further science.
Well, you probably know that the oldest scientific institution in Australia is, in fact, the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, which was established in 1816.
Well, plants always played a massively important role in any human endeavour. The building of cities was linked to the cultivation of wheat and various other crops, so wherever people went to colonise, especially the Europeans, they did bring their plants and their botanists with them, normally on their first journey, and long may that continue.
And would you like to show me around what you've just been boasting about? Now I've got Johannes down close to the laboratories, and we've got this completely different view of the cocoon. Gosh, it's huge, isn't it?
The cocoon is massive, apparently the largest sprayed concrete structure in Europe, so that's something to be proud of, until, of course, we do a life-size model of Pamela Anderson, then.
Oh, you're going to do that? Yes, she'll be pleased.
Yeah, well, curvatures might be just about the same proportion. So anyway, the science of natural history has changed. In the past, a microscope, pencil and a piece of paper was just about all right. Today, we use sequencing robots, we use state-of-the-art imaging facilities, because the task of exploring the natural world is a complicated one, is an exciting one, and technology is helping us to achieve that.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you're integrating the old-fashioned collection of different species and doing the classification, but still, at the other end, looking at the internal parts and linking them together. You're not just dispensing with one and doing the other, but you're doing both.
Integrative research is the key to push forward the frontiers of knowledge today. And we are actually quite fortunate having this long 350, 400 year time series of collections of the natural world in this building, but also being able to capitalize on scientific technological advances, mainly by medicine and various other applied sciences. So we can really marry the two, and it's very, very good that we've combined both side by side in a building like this.
Do you ever have scientists from the universities drop in to be partners with you as part of these experiments?
We have active collaborations with scientists in 60 countries all over the world. We have active collaboration with hundreds of different universities across the world, as well as in Europe and the UK. We have lots of people of different nationalities working in this museum. I'm myself German, but they come from all over the world, including Australia, New Zealand.
Well, that's really the nature of science itself these days. It's not something that you have isolated in a new building or an old one, but it's a kind of web that connects all parts of the world, all parts of the natural world. Finally, let's go to the collections where you keep your plants. And here we are in what looks like a bank vault. Quiet, grey, vast, huge numbers of containers with strange sort of 22nd century handles that almost like robots. Johannes, what's this?
Well, we are now here inside the cocoon, and this is a big concrete room where we house the prized specimens, our collection. You are looking in this room now at probably 1 million specimens of plants from all over the world. They're housed in cabinets. Perhaps I can open one, which hopefully doesn't make a creaky noise.
Wonderfully smooth, yes. Ah, but wonderful old-fashioned files.
Yes. There are lots of files here. You see stacks and stacks of them, and if you pull one out, then you can see the plant specimens nicely stacked on top, one on top of each other.
The actual dried specimens, as we've become used to, and with little labels at the bottom, some saying somewhere in here, no doubt, collected by Charles Darwin.
Yeah, of course, of course, of course. And what you can also see is that some folders have a slight red mark on it.
Yeah.
And these are the folders which contain the type specimens. These are the specimens from which the original plant was described, not just things that look like it, but the actual thing to which the name was given. And you can see here rows and rows of red folders. We are one of the most type-rich collections in the world, and that comes from the 350-year history of exploring the plant world, which is all summarised and catalogued here in this very room.
In this very room, and I presume you won't let the public loose in here.
No, we even don't let our scientists loose in here.
Well, I feel privileged.
Yes, you are. What we've done now for the first time, which is of great, great importance, is we've separated people and plants. People shed skin, they do eat food, they might carry animals around with them, and we want to protect them. So this is just a storeroom. It's 17 degrees here, temperatures probably unheard of in Australia, 45 degrees humidity. This is where we keep our plants safe, especially safe from insects and other organisms that want to eat them. So if you want to work with them, you take them out of this room, work in the ends of the cocoon, what you can see there, lots and lots of rows of benches where you can lay out the specimens and compare and contrast nicely. But then they go back in safe storage here. So it's a completely new way of safeguarding the heritage that we have been entrusted for on behalf of the world. This is an international collection. We are an international organisation. We are just by accident of history situated in London.
Well, my final question to you, apart from the public, we'll have to ask the public what they think of this wonderful Darwin II Centre, as big as it is and innovative, but what about other museums? Are they looking at you with envy, or are some of them doing the same thing?
A lot of organisations now looking for the museum to see what type of standards for natural history collections and care we have adopted. But especially if you look at countries like China, Indonesia, the emerging mega economies in the East, they are already building buildings to this standard. They have at the moment the capacity in relation to cash flow and so on and so forth to do that. But in order to preserve the natural history of the world, at least as far as we want to have collections rather than preserving them in the wild, these are the standards that need to be adopted everywhere across the world. And I know that Australia does the same. So this is just how it has to be done these days. This building was originally opened in 1881, and everybody believed that that was the standard of care that collections need to be looked after. Then time has moved on. I suspect in 50, 60 years' time, times will have moved on again, and we may need to build Darwin Centre 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Johannes, I shall come back then and meet you here.
Oh, any time. Very welcome.
Johannes Vogel, Officer Commanding Plants at the Natural History Museum in London, where you're most welcome too. He's married to Sarah Darwin, by the way, a descendant of Charles. She too works at the museum, so we have a true continuation of the Darwin tradition in many ways. Next week in The Science Show, we seek out buffalo in the Top End and listen to Antarctic icebergs crack up while sitting comfortably in Perth. On Catalyst, join me touring the brand new RIOs. That's the Royal Institution Australia. Production today by Nikki Phillips and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.